Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
Hello and welcome back to the PLO Happy Hour Podcast. Alongside Chris Rosenthal, I'm Kevin Brown for Inside Lacrosse. Rosie, 12 weeks down and the regular season is over. Three more weeks to go for the postseason. Our first Women's Lacrosse League champion crowned. Rosie, how are you feeling after an eventful Philadelphia weekend?
Fired up and a little exhausted. But yeah, no, it's wild to think that the whole regular season is all in the background now. And it's just, win or go home, as they say. Things are about to get real intense.
And no matter how many people Bill Tierney has bullied along his way of coaching career or growing up, the Philadelphia Water Dogs escape with a 9-3 record. Escape, they dominate with a 9-3 record. A bit of a lackluster performance at the finale on their back-to-back. Referring to his post-game comments there after that Whipsnakes win, you know, a bit of a grinded-out win where he was like, listen, you know, they're back-to-back here. We just played twice in the Denver weekend, too, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. And two very strong opponents in both those occasions. They really proved they're the class of the league. They get the number one seed and the bye in the Eastern Conference. They'll face the winner of Boston and Maryland in the Eastern Conference. That bracket was all set entering the weekend. So we were just wondering if anything crazy would happen out west, and nothing really did. Bit of a switcheroo with the 2 and 3 seeds as the California Redwoods danced out to a 18-11 victory against the Denver Outlaws. And boy, oh boy, they are injured going into the postseason. So something to monitor for us two, Rosie, as we get our previews worked on throughout this bye week. Could not come at a better time for Tim Sudan to get Jared Bernhardt, Pat Cavanaugh, and the entire close starting defense back a little healthier. So they will face that winner for the Utah Archers, the privilege to play Utah in Utah, Salt Lake City, for the semifinals. Some good quarterfinal matchups. Rosie, which side are you more excited for, the Eastern Conference or the Western Conference?
I say I'm more excited for the Eastern Conference just based on what we've seen most recently. The Denver Outlaws, I'll say, as far as the West goes, it's going to be intriguing to see how/if they can get it done. You know what I mean? Really kind of patching together and crawling their way through the mud to try to get there. Just night and day compared to last season, right? You know, they're just kind of steamrolling people left and right. And this season, they're really just trying to basically get through to the finish line. And now they've got to kind of, you know, figure out what they can do, figure out who's going to be available to that degree. So, you know, like a lot of their on-field and off-field stuff, there's a lot of interesting stuff to watch there. But as far as, you know, if you're going to a game, you want to see the action play out. It's been really exciting to see what the Canons have put together recently. You know, the ball movement's been at a premium. The offense has been gelling, and they've had their share of big moments, you know, stepping up clutch performances. So really exciting to see what they're going to have coming after this bye for them. And a Whipsnakes team that has had similar ball movement, high-octane performances, just not consistently through an entire game. You know, we've seen the sparks from the Whipsnakes, but we haven't seen them string together an entire sort of masterpiece, right? And, you know, if it's going to happen, it better happen in this upcoming matchup. But they do have an opponent in those Boston Cannons who we've seen kind of put together some more kind of, you know, big moments and have had several guys stepping up. So it's really going to be interesting to see and exciting, I think, to see who's going to be able to deliver, you know, the most consistent high-octane performance when the two meet up.
No doubt. It's a long break for the Boston Cannons, who win 6 of the last 7, 3 weeks going into their playoff matchup. You look at the Utah Archers, they had a full month off going into the semifinals. We saw that with the Denver Outlaws. Pretty slow start, I believe, in their semifinal last year. I think that was kind of the storyline going into it. And, you know, they ended up escaping the Redwoods there and making it one of the most memorable title games I've ever covered at Sports Illustrated Stadium in New Jersey, where it will return. So make sure, if you're a local, or even if you're not, get to the East Coast for that PLL title game, because it was phenomenal. Rosie, I don't know. I think you laid it out well, that the Eastern Conference matchup, probably a little more exciting with, and we'll get into the nitty gritty, but just for later in the episode, but just for like a big picture point of view, like Boston, exciting, hottest team in the league, the Whipsnakes. They have all the pieces. They have a lot of the pieces. They have a couple weaknesses that teams are exploiting, and it's leading to some late-game collapses. Most recently, they gave a great fight. And, Rosie, before we get to the nitty-gritty, I'm curious if you had any more time to think about a question I posed to you in the press box, where, you know, some other media members were like, oh, man, I can tell what they were thinking. It was a pretty good question. So I was like, I got to bring this up again. Rosie, your response to this was great, because I was like, man, are the Maryland Whipsnakes providing the, like, the blueprint to beat these Water Dogs? Because I think we can agree the Philly is the class of the league right now. They're head and shoulders above the rest of the league with the amount of talent they have on paper. Now, it's almost embarrassing they didn't win by another 10 goals in their regular season finale. But listen, they beat Atlas 18-10, pretty resounding victory there. Very low stakes game, and they grinded out for an impressive effort to end the season 9-3. And I turned to you, it's you know, the Whips had just tied it 9-9. It's they get out to 11-9. I'm like, man, this is quite the blueprint, huh? From defensively, like, how are they doing this? Is that the case, or is it more so that the Water Dogs are just playing on a back-to-back and they have nothing really to play for, already locking up the number one seed? And you turn to me and you're like, the blueprint? What, because they held them to 11? Like, the Water Dogs are still winning, man.
Right. It's, you know, yeah, it's still a win, you know? And I think I think what we've seen from the Water Dogs during this run is they have found different ways to do it. You know, there is a lot we can certainly say, and I'm sure we will, about the kind of season that Michael Sowers has put together, kind of season we've seen with C.J. Kearse, his performance, and what he's been able to do working in tandem with Sowers and the rest of that offense. But we've also seen some guys kind of step up a little bit. I think this was a good weekend that kind of demonstrated it. You know, if you need a couple goals here and there from some rookie midfielders, you know, I mean, that might kind of be, if you are fortunate enough to you know, quote, make them beat you one way or another, and, you know, maybe you kind of lean to try to get all of the pressure on your Josh Yagos and, you know, your midfielders, and hope that maybe them, you know, the rookie factor will kind of come into play, and you can maybe throw them off a little bit in that sort of aspect, you know, but at least in times, it certainly seems like they've reached kind of pick your poison status on the way that this offense looks.
And that's why this Maryland-Boston matchup is going to be so interesting, because I do think the Whip Snakes rookie short stick defense midfielders match up quite well with those rookie midfielders for the offensive midfielders for the Water Dogs. So if they can get past Boston, like I like their chances almost more than a Boston team who, you know, Zach Goodrich, Ben Ramsey, Jeff Traynor, solid group. But when you're going up against Kyle Lewis, Josh Yago, Matt Collison, like, man, whoever is not getting that pull, Ethan Rawl or whoever is in there, like, that's a tough look. So, Rosie, I was also pontificating, if you will, on the similarities between the top – refresh my memory. Do you think – so to finish my thought, the top of the Eastern Conference, the top of the league, rather, this year, the Philadelphia Water Dogs, I found have had some relatively good similarities with the reigning champion New York Atlas. Now, of course, maybe not what they want to hear falling to – inverse records here, 9-3 and 3-9, coming after the regular season. But listen, injuries happen. You look at that is what makes the Denver Outlaws pretty impressive this season, because the Atlas have been able to muster up really nothing without Teat and, you know, Trevor Baptiste. I think they've had more key injuries, but with Trevor Baptiste out, Connor Schellenberger has not been himself and had to exit early again in the finale. But when they were all healthy, like, two of the top three point producers in the league, that was Jeff Teat, number three, Connor Schellenberger was one. This season, it's obviously Michael Sauers with 51 points. That's the MVP favorite coming away from the regular season. CJ Kirst sets the single season goals record with 34 goals, finishes third overall in points. And yeah, at 39 overall. And we'll get to Sauers lefty shooting in a second here, Rosie, but like, similarities don't end with the dynamic duo partnership. I think both those duos, you can already kind of rank in the upper echelon of all-time tandems in pro lacrosse history. The year three seems to be a good one for legendary college head coaches, as Mike Pressler, you know, he goes from a pretty bad first season. You know, he starts to figure it out. That devastating semifinal loss to the Whip Snakes in 2024, and then they climb the mountaintop in 2025. Bill Tierney's like, does the same thing. He gets that first pick for CJ Kirst with a pretty rough debut season. It pays off in 2025 with a semifinal berth that the New York Atlas defeat them in Philadelphia. I have zero recollection of that game. We were talking about it at Subaru Park. I'm sure. I think we were both there, Rosie. I do not remember it. And now they're poised to make a run a game away from the title game here. Both teams will have MVPs. It's either going to be CJ Kirst or Michael Sauers. I'll get your thoughts on that later. But Rosie, how about these similarities? Any others you see with them? Anything strike your ear when you hear it all kind of broken down, laid out like that?
First extra similarity that comes to mind, the presence of Gavin Adler. Kind of the running through you know, the heart and soul of both of those defenses.
Yes, sir.
Certainly makes things a little bit easier, helps everybody's job get a little bit smoother when you have Gavin Adler heading up the defense for you there. But yeah, you know, I think something I hadn't noticed was the experience factor that you mentioned with the coaches. I hadn't noticed the actual years that come into play there. But, you know, it does make a lot of sense, right? You know, I think college coaches probably have a general idea of what has worked so well for them. And then you kind of have that shock of, you know, you're not practicing every day with these guys. They have their, you know, their lives and their own separate places that they live and all that stuff. And then you kind of have to figure out what it's going to take to, you know, make your adjustments and kind of, you know, figure things out if it's compromise wise or, you know, just kind of realign your priorities. We hear that a lot from Bill Tierney. You know, he'll say, you know, we only get this many practices. We need to, you know, get this done and that done. It's really kind of, you know, it's just such a different animal from the whole college coaching experience. But it's not a surprise that these guys who were so good at college coaching figure out what it takes, right? What they do need to kind of tweak and do need to adjust to get the most out of their guys once they do reach the pro level. And any other similarities? I don't know. I think you basically nailed the most prevalent ones. But yeah, no, there are some very interesting similarities between those two organizations. Of course, we'll see if the Water Dog story ends the same way this season and moving forward, I guess.
Gary McArdle and company are certainly hoping so. I asked him that question coming away from the win against the Atlas on Saturday. He was like, I hope we win the title like they did. Of course, a former member of the inaugural Atlas way back when, if I'm not mistaken. But you are correct. The most obvious similarity being that Defensive Player of the Year, reigning Defensive Player of the Year, Gavin Adler, the free agent key acquisition this offseason for the Philadelphia Water Dogs, really just started the momentum for Dave Cottle's first season at the helm of the general manager position, because boy, oh boy, did he draft well. We saw with these rookie midfielders, it is pick your poison, man, like Josh Yago. We don't know how long he can avoid the Space Force. We caught up with Sean Byrne post game, and his future is also up in there. So it's kind of a nice little human interest element as well of like, all right, some of these like young guys are also on borrowed time of like, they don't know how long they can play the pro game. So when you're having a dynamic offensive talent like Josh Yago, give it us all every single rep. And Sean Byrne is so locked in and such a team guy, 20 saves, and I think 19 on Saturday? Was,
yeah, 19 the day before.
Pretty insane weekend for him as an athletics intern for at West Point. He's stationed at, and he gets his assignment in December. And then from there, it's really reliant on his commanding officer and how much of a ball knower he is, or whether you're going to let him play some PLL ball here. So shout out those guys. Salute you for your service, and hopefully we can see more of you, because we love watching those guys play.
Yeah, and you know, it's good that you mentioned those guys who are kind of on borrowed time, or we're not really certain how long they're going to be around, because I think that's a lesson that we have definitely seen from the Atlas. Yes, they, you know, they were hit by a whole bunch of very crucial injuries. But the kind of overlying message there is you don't know if you're going to get back to the championship, right? You don't, you know, there's not necessarily this, okay, we'll get them next year. Or, you know, Mike Pressler was kind of making that point in his kind of, I guess, exit interview of a press conference. You know, he was like, you know, 25, we won it all, but you know, that team's not going to be the same. And he said the same thing for 26. This team's not going to be the same. You know, like the Water Dogs have to be very aware of that. It's not so much where you're in a situation where you're kind of building bricks for the franchise. You got to win now. And who knows if you get back or if the road's going to be as smooth as they made it look lately.
Rosie, another team who may not look the same ever again, but did write their names, etch their names in WLL history as the first ever champions, was the Maryland Charms. 16-13 title game victory over the California Palms at Subaru Park. Rosie, we got to witness it firsthand. I got to talk to some of the players and Coach Emily Perros on the field post-game. It was an absolute blast covering kind of a historic moment. Hopefully we can build off it. It was only a four-game season. There's plenty of international competition to come, but there's no international competition in the summer next season, so there should be definitely more than four games. The Sixes competitions in international play are not till October and November, I believe, in 2027. And then, obviously, the LA Olympics in 2028 are a big priority for the sport moving forward. So that is going to be a schedule headache that they're going to have to work around. But 2027, to build off a 26 season that was the as Paul Rabil as acknowledged in past interviews with myself and others, that it kind of came quicker than they intended or imagined, with Athletes Unlimited opting not to play any longer. They planned on just being coinciding forces with them, and until AU folded and we're like, listen, these women are playing too many international tournaments, is what they cited. WLL takes on the baton. Four-game regular season. The two clear best teams, 3-1, both of them. Rosie, we were lucky enough to be there in person for the 18-17 game at Loyola. And boy, oh boy, did this game deliver. Sydney Black, we saw it each championship series. She had no help. The first year, she got a little more help. I think Allie Kennedy came in, maybe a couple others the second year, but they couldn't get it done. Still in last place. Allie Kennedy, Kaylee Waters, they're like, yeah, whatever. Two straight last place finishes. Listen, this championship series stuff's not our thing. Listen, we're going to win the thing that matters, and that's the inaugural WL championship.
Yeah, absolutely. Unflappable confidence, despite all the, all the evidence that may have pointed to the contrary. I think it certainly seemed like something they didn't forget. We did hear that a couple times during their post-game press conferences. You know, they did it despite what other people might have thought,
Too much chaos 2021 vibes, man. Unbelievable.
they didn't shy away from throwing a couple jabs in there.
Who was doubting them?
Were we doubting them?
Of course, anything I say on this podcast or write in past publication is erased from public memory.
Who knows where they, maybe somebody said something. I don't think it was me. I'm sure it was somebody else. But, whoever said something, they remembered it, kind of, and they embraced not being the favorites. 14 league is going to be super stacked at all teams, right? But, I guess kind of they looked at it sort of like, well, we don't have this one person on our team that we kind of have to, rely on them to carry us. They do have superstars, right? It's not like this scrappy bunch of nobodies, right? These are highly decorated people. But I also get the point. I get what they're saying, right? They don't have a Charlotte North that, maybe everybody knows, even if they don't really know lacrosse teams, right? Or they don't have an Izzy Skein, who's kind of in that same sort of stratosphere. But they never stopped believing in themselves, and they just kept fighting. And then, Allie Kennedy was very much right. They were a full field kind of team. And tremendously impressive. Can't say enough good stuff about the way that they put that organization together. Good drafting, good coaching. Emily Perros doesn't really love taking all the credit, She's very quick to get rid of it. She did not miss GM-wise. Bridget Duffy was a monster all season there for him when she came into play. And yeah, it was a great performance by the Charm. Can definitely say there's some parity in that four-team league. No one team is so awful that you know, you look at him, you're like, oh, there's no way out of this for you. And yeah, no, I think this is a great stepping stone, and the league did a lot of awesome work, and it seemed like the fans were super into it, and you know, definitely cause to be optimistic. If you liked what you saw, it's probably a lot more to come.
What was your favorite part of the title game?
So, let me say, off-field wise, my favorite part was there was so much, like, not just people there to watch a lacrosse game. You know, like, oh, I hear there are two lacrosse teams playing. I'll go watch them. Or, you know, oh, my kid plays lacrosse. Let me bring her to watch these people. Like, there were Palms fans, right? And there were Charm fans. And, you know, if a call got, there's, you know, they challenged that goal call and it turns out no goal. Boo. You know, you hear a massive boo and there was a penalty called and massive booing. And just the pink stands out so much that you could just see these massive swarms of pink. So, like, you know, years from now, when I look back at going to the first one, what I'm going to remember most of all, other than Sydney Black's dodge, there, I think if I remember two things, it would be Sydney Black with that ankle breaking dodge. But then it would also be just the crowds that were there rooting with intent more than just kind of there to watch a spectacle, because that feels more like a buy-in, right? Like people are actually there because, like, all right, hey, my Palms made it to the championship. Let's go, right? Like that kind of atmosphere more than just going to watch a game. So I was very blown away by that, blown away by all the jerseys I saw. We talk a lot about, like, they get a lot of questions about, you know, what would you say to a little girl in the stands who wants to be like you? And, you know, what's it been like seeing these little girls who look up to you? But, like, when you're walking through the tunnels, you know, before these games, obviously there are a ton of little girls in Palms jerseys, but there are also, like, grown-ass men walking around with Palms jerseys, right? And there's just, you know, little boys with Palms jerseys. And,
right, right.
You know, just everybody. Everybody, all shapes and sizes and whatevers. So, yeah, that's what I'm going to remember most about it. Just kind of the atmosphere and specific rooting with intent.
As the atmosphere of the weekend, by far, the Philly fans showed out. A lot of pink in the stands. And the Palms fans were a little disappointed by the way the game ended, but their Palms fought. It was a great season from them. The only team that could beat them was the champs. So tip your cap there. Midfield battle. Wrote about it heading into the game, and it lived up to the hype. Anna Brandt doing what she does, taking LSATs and taking names going into that game. Just what she had, 4 or 5 goals, just ripping it on the run. The Ali Mastriani take off the draw, lefty, down the alley, it was pretty memorable late. And Marie McCool was a very calming presence for them. They seemed pretty zeroed in on her defensively. So, great matchup. Ellie Massera got things started. And that was kind of their midfield quartet, was kind of how they did things. And you look at Emilio Pinto down in attack. Abby Bosco was just, she proved how great of a one-on-one defender she is with this rule set, because she does play aggressively. A lot of stick checks, and she had a few takeaways in there. Two-goalie system, Kaylee Waters crushed it first half. Not always easy, I'm sure, to split time like that, but they had the same system all season. And when you have a national champion coming off a Northwestern title, and Jenica Cuoco, who made some crazy saves in Final Four weekend and all throughout the NCAA tournament, finished with 9 saves in the second half. So Taylor Moreno, great game from her from a Palms perspective. And, of course, the press tour with Allie Kennedy, her partner, being on different sides of the game, just a level of intrigue that it's pretty hard to match in any sport, let alone lacrosse, just with the star power and those two names being a who they are. And Allie Kennedy, of course, showed out. So, like you said, like Bridget Duffy to draft her with your first pick for Emily Parros, like that's kind of a gutsy move. Yeah, win now move from a player from Army. And it paid off because she was one of the best players in the entire league. So athletic. Saw her dart underneath. Just insane stats. I think she had 2-2 and six GBs in this one. She was awesome. Just everywhere all at once. And when you combine her with Allie Kennedy, they kind of had the advantage at attack where Ashley Humphrey with all those assists, the NCAA all-time assist leader, Sam Apuzzo doing what she does. It was great post-game catching up with her saying like, listen, Sydney Black's looking up to you her whole life. What's it like seeing her doing what she did? She's like, oh, now I look up to her. It's pretty cool seeing like a little bit of a passing of the torch that kind of resonates in on both the PLL and WLL sides. So the scoring, the pace, the finish wasn't as dramatic as Loyola, but credit to the charm defense that it hunkered down and eliminated those Palm Storettes. And let's hear from a couple charm players, starting with the player who touched it last, Jenica Kuoko, getting to the rare double title in one season.
And we're here with Maryland Charm second half goalie, Jenica Kuoko. Jenica, two titles in 1 year. What's it like?
It kind of feels surreal. I'm just getting over the first one, so now I never have to stop celebrating, so it's pretty awesome.
From the Northwestern title to now, how have you been able to kind of soak in these moments?
Yeah, by just honestly being grateful for every second that I'm able to be a part of this opportunity. It's kind of awesome to be part of history, so I'm just keeping great mindset and happy to be here.
What's it like being a part of this current team?
Everything. They've been so welcoming. They've made my time here so fun, and they're like my sisters at this point.
And what's it like specifically learning and playing alongside Kaylee?
Yeah, she's awesome. She brings such life and fun and great energy to this game and to this position. So being able to learn from her and trying to be a sponge around her is awesome, and I feel like she's made me a better person and a goalie.
Being able to be the one with the ball, final whistle, put that emotion into words for me.
Yeah, I got a taste of it winning the national championship, so I wanted the ball at the end, and everyone was telling me to send it, so they were backing me on it, and it's awesome. It's just to cherish the moments with my teammates is great.
Congrats, Jenica.
Thank you.
Now, quickly, let's throw it to Allie Kennedy. She was on quite the press tour, but I loved her response of the need to kind of do that in the week leading up to it.
We're here with WLL champion Allie Kennedy. Allie, what's it like hearing that?
Amazing. Dream come true. Still doesn't feel real. Once I go in the locker room, hopefully it'll set in and we'll get to celebrate a little bit more. But right now, I'm just so happy. So happy my family's here and proud.
Allie, you're on quite the press tour for this game.
Yes.
Week leading up to it. Just describe the emotions immediately after the final whistle.
Yeah, I think it was a long week, press, but you know, it's a sacrifice. It's part of it. It's getting Women's Lacrosse on the platform that it deserves to be. And I'm happy that it paid off. I'm happy that that game was amazing and it was fun to watch. And relief, honestly, after the final whistle.
And lastly, just from your point of view, against a very athletic and talented California team, just how did you pull away?
I think our attackers were the difference, honestly. Their middies are great. I think Anna Brandt went off, like Allie Mastriani went off. They're so talented across the board. Taylor got hot. But our attackers always making that one more pass, and then some of our middies making tough plays in the middle of the field. It was just a team win all across the stat sheet, I think, was filled. So I'm just proud of all of us, and it took every single member of that team to win this.
Last but not least, the championship MVP. Got to hear from Sydney Black. Obviously, we talked about that ankle snatcher. Rosie, I think you got a better response from her post-game at the podium. But She was nothing but respect on the field, where, you know, just feet yards away from where she had that jab left dart underneath to send Emily Knowles to the grass. Well, let's hear what she had to say.
We're here with Championship MVP Sydney Black. Sydney, what's working well for you today?
I just think our offense and our defense combined for the best performance of the season for us. Everyone played with their entire hearts, and I think it showed out there that, you know, we have so much fun together and we love each other, and it helped with the result on the scoreboard.
That's a talented California defense, very
Absolutely.
Athletic. How did you break them down and do what you did well?
Yeah, I mean, you're playing against the best in the world in their defense and their defenders and their middies, and we knew they were going to come out fighting, and I think we went punch for punch pretty well in the first quarter. So just sticking true to our game plan and having fun and playing together.
It's a historic first. Sydney, what's it like to be the first?
I mean, it's history books right there. I think it's amazing to go down in history as the first ever champions, and a game on ESPN, an amazing crowd in the stands. It's something we'll never forget, and hopefully little girls watching inspired to just continue dreaming big.
And what's next for you and your Maryland teammates?
We're going to celebrate. We're going to celebrate really hard tonight. Yeah.
Congrats.
Terrific insights from those players indeed. Rosie, overall, big picture-wise, let's close out this WLL segment with just some overall season takeaways. What did you like? What did you take away from the inaugural full 10v10 WLL season?
You know, I'm not privy to the numbers, right? Or, you know, the total gate draw kind of side of things, but it seemed like a huge success. The attendance was, you know, was hearty and enthusiastic. They had previously announced at one of the earlier stops that had set a new record for attendance. I think it was Fairfield, where they might have been, where they said, you know, this is the biggest crowd we've ever had. And, you know, I would have guessed that before that, you know, California might have had, you know, bumped it up. It seemed like it was just getting bigger and bigger as the summer continued. Very limited schedule-wise, but I think, you know, that's probably a good thing for the first one. You want to kind of get a couple dates out there, test the waters. You know, it's one thing for fans to be like, yeah, sure, I'd watch. But then, you know, when you actually put them to the test and they have to, you know, give their money and show up, you know, sometimes people are not necessarily as inclined to follow through. So, you know, I would have loved more games, but I think the future will have more games, a more extended season. And, you know, I think the product was fantastic. The games were fun. I heard from a lot of people who were not really big, you know, women's college fans or anything like that. Maybe they kind of knew what their schools did or something like that, but caught some WLL games. And, you know, I heard from some people who were like, I actually love watching the WLL. I guess I'm a women's lacrosse fan now. You know, I think they made a lot of fans with just the speed and style of play that was just kind of, you know, fantastic. You know, a whole bunch of highlights. You know, I think about like Erin Coikendall ripping that BTB as she's falling to the ground. There was something like that almost every weekend that they were out there. That was just, you know, made for great, exciting television. And above all, I think the players themselves are really, really good at just marketing themselves, you know, interacting with interviews, interacting with the press. They're excited to be there, but they're also, you know, excited to try to promote the game. And a lot of them are really like just kind of personable and funny, relaxed people, you know, in front of a camera or in front of media opportunities. They seem like they've been doing it a really long time. So I think, you know, you can go down the list. You know, you mentioned Allie Kennedy, you know, put Alex Ostholman.
Not in a bad way either. The way that's not media trained or absolutely authentic, these people.
Yeah, 1,000% authentic. So many of them just crush that side of things. And, you know, we've seen billions of athletes who that does not come naturally to. And, you know, even years after years getting practice with it, it's still just not their thing. Because, you know, it's not for everybody. But so many of these WLL players are just like, yeah, give me a mic and I will be super comfortable and super cool in front of it. So I think they crushed both the on-field and off-field stuff. I'm really excited to see what, you know, what comes up next for them.
I'm no expert in this stratosphere, but the rules, the rule set of the WLL is yields a lot more free flowing, a lot more faster paced, and just a game that shows off the skill and athleticism that women's lacrosse deserves. College, take notice. But also, listen, it's the nuance of that conversation is, like, these players are so talented that, like, some of the checks that they get away with are the offenses in the college game might not be able to cope with. They might be getting injured. So, not the expert to the reference on this, but certainly a noticeable, more flowing state of WLL to follow. Rosie, the PLL playoffs are upon us, and as the WLL season closes, there are still six teams in the hunt for the PLL 2026 title game, no matter if you think one team has already won it, like some Philadelphia fans may. Before we get there, we have to get to Minnesota, Minneapolis. How about it? The Minneapolis fans always show out. The Western Conference game will be first. The Denver Outlaws versus California Redwoods at 6 p.m. 8:30 is Maryland versus Boston. We'll start with that one, Rosie. Just two very different great games in the regular season, right? Kind of indicated two very different teams at that stage, where the Maryland Whipsnakes beat them up pretty good at Loyola. A 17-10 game where they were making their off-ball defense look silly with their crazy quick ball movement and Joey Spallina's debut. And then all of a sudden at Harvard, at Boston's homecoming, they another late game collapse presents Marcus Holman the opportunity to hit an open netter from 2-point range. We didn't get to podcast about it a couple weeks ago, but we're talking about it now. Rosie, I think it's obvious that this game, playoff wise, will be closer to the second meeting. What do you think will be? What do you take away from kind of those encounters and into this playoff matchup?
First thing I want to touch on real quick about that game winner back at Harvard, shout out to Marcus Holman for making that shot, because if he picks up the ball and misses that empty net with the immediate possession at overtime, and then Maryland goes down and does something with it, I feel like he probably feels like a huge jerk for trying it. So you got to have the confidence to try it. So good for him. And he stuck it. So, yeah, nice work.
Well, it's a very crazy ending. It was dramatic, exciting, all the above. The fact that he took about 5-10 steps upfield when he got the ball was, I think, maybe the only gripe that you can have with the play.
Yeah. You know, it's... I think for whatever he needed to do to kind of calibrate the angle, you know, you see all the mathematic equations circling around his head before the whistle went off. And I guess he just knew where he needed to position himself to have a better shot. who knows? I don't understand what kind of professor levels he's operating on right now, but.
Well, it was sheer hustle to start. Like the cut through, obviously the tie it. He had to cut through the open space for McKelly. He has another cut through to kind of just stay in the play, and just the chase out to the ground ball. Like, man, we saw some of that with obviously his wife having a vintage game too. Shout out WLL with article coming there too with her contributions and a hat trick after not playing much the regular season. Something the Holman family, they want it more this season. We'll see if Mark Holman can have the same title luck as Alex.
Yeah, absolutely. As far as the next Maryland-Boston matchup, big thing I'm curious about is if Maryland is going to have an answer for Andrew McMeekin and how much it's going to affect them if they don't, you know? Because it's one thing to lose a bunch of faceoffs, and that happens, and it doesn't necessarily ruin your entire game. But we've clearly seen Boston, and we've clearly seen McMeekin and Holman and McAsee kind of in particular benefiting from it. Not just him winning, but turning it into immediate offense. So when we've also seen Baltimore been on the receiving end of that kind of stuff, you know, in their matchup, not only previously against Boston, but also when they were dealing with not having, you know, any sort of faceoff help when they're playing against the Denver Outlaws. And, you know, they're giving up a bunch of points right off of those faceoff whistles. So, you know, certainly expect them to dress a faceoff guy. You know, they brought a new one in this past weekend. Thought he did a pretty good job, or at least a good enough job, they felt. But really, I think it's more about just kind of slowing down that kind of Boston, you know, pushing it forward and making something happen right away. You know, even if you're not going to hold McMeekin to like 50% or something like that, you know, if he gets 65%, but he doesn't have two or three points as well, you know, that's the kind of thing that could really push this out of hand for the Whipsnakes if he ends up on some points as well. So that's something I'm really looking forward to seeing if they have something drawn up to kind of silence that element of the Boston game.
No doubt. It's they have to dress a face-off guy, right? Nathan Kapp is the guy who you referenced, came in there. Jacksonville ties with Staggs' son, who spent a fifth year there. Kapp went 57% PLL debut. Pretty good. Pretty good against Alex Dathkis. And I believe that's how he fared. Anyway, you got to dress a face-off guy against McMeekin.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think Staggs would want to try to, I guess for lack of a better word, try to get cute and work his way around it. I think you're just going to have the best available face-off guy they can have, and I would assume it's going to be Kapp again. And, you know, just bring him out there and say, you know, hey, you know what this guy wants to do? Try to at least stop him from going forward with it. And, you know, they can deal with the rest from there. Turn it into a wing fight or something like that if Cap's not winning them clean.
The shorthand lingo these days from Staggs, trading 32 for 52. That's 32 second shot clock possessions after faceoff wins for you newcomers to the pod. The playoff time is so interesting because, like, we've seen catch up to Boston's offense when they are winning too many faceoffs and they have to play too many 32-second shot clock possessions. They've been pretty efficient recently, especially when McMeekin can take it himself, obviously. But the level of concern I have overall is these two offenses are, I think, not fully playoff ready. Like, this Maryland Whipsnakes offense is so predicated off great ball movement that they need Aiden Carroll to be initiating and get that defense rotating. TJ Malone was shut out pretty well by Gavin Adler in that season finale. Didn't have too many touches, felt like. And as a result, it all landed on Aiden Carroll's shoulders. Now, a week off will be great for a guy like Matt Brandau. We saw his knee all braced up. So seeing that and how that translates. And then you look at the Boston offense where they balled out against the Utah Archers last time we saw them, I think. And Brian Kelly just continues to amaze. Like, they played the Redwoods, scored 12 on them. And of course, the Whipsnakes game that we mentioned in their homecoming weekend. But Brian Kelly, just a phenomenal season from him. How does that translate to the playoff time with Mark Solomon and Colton Maxey. Maxey's really getting all the touches in this offense. He's among the touches leaders. Let's see if, he finished the regular season with the most touches in the entire league, 10 more than his line mate, Mark Solomon. So the offense is completely revolving around them. They came into the season as such a midfield predicated unit, and Matt Campbell goes down. Ryan Drenner was down already. And, you know, they were relying heavily on Kelly. He had been in and out of the lineup. So how does Marcus Holman and company show up in this postseason? Because that's a tough Whip Snakes defense when you get down to the September time. So the offenses and how they can cope in these high pressure situations. Is there one you trust more in the fourth quarter in this matchup, Rosie?
Blindly, I'm going to say blindly, I'm going to say Boston, because when I think about Maryland offense this season, I think about just being plagued by huge droughts of production, right? Like, that's been a thing. Sometimes it's been a late game thing. Sometimes it's been, you know, the second and third quarter or whatever, but you often look up at the end of these Whip Snakes games and you're like, you know, these guys went 18 minutes without scoring a goal here. You know, these guys went 23 minutes without scoring a goal. And there's just been these giant lapses. Now, without having done the research, maybe Boston's had a similar sort of effect. But just kind of what I recall is I feel like it's almost been a hallmark, similar to the way that you think about the Atlas season and you're like, well, guys getting hurt all the time. When I think about the Maryland offense, I think just absolute silence as far as, be it, you know, shot clock violations or something like that, not being able to generate good looks, or sometimes just not getting to retain the ball. Sometimes maybe a transition play that results in a turnover before you get a shot on cage, you know, something like that, not necessarily being able to make the most of the opportunities that end up becoming a bit more few and far between than the offense would expect. But that's just kind of an element of their game that I've had to kind of attach to it this season. So, you know,
particularly when they have a lead and it's in the second half.
Yeah, you can't really get around it. There have just been times where they got real quiet for real long periods of time. So, you know, a couple teams have different reasons to say this, but as far as consistent scoring goes from the Whip Snakes, they're kind of on a, you know, prove it sort of basis. Individually, obviously, great performers who you would think, yeah, you know, I need a goal here, make something happen, right? Like, you know, hey, we need something to happen. Give the ball to Rob Pinnell. It seems like a good idea, right? All right, hey, Joey Spolina, make something happen, right? There's individuals who, you know, for whatever reason that they've earned throughout the years, they do kind of have that sort of, you know, I guess some sort of benefit of the doubt, if you want to call it, based on like a late game or an, you know, insular play, kind of make something happen ability. But team-wise, yeah, I think they're on kind of a prove-it basis as far as consistent scoring throughout and late game scoring.
Yeah, it's interesting. Rob Pinnell been fighting some hamstring issues, and those matchups, when you look at it with TJ Malone going up against a guy like Owen Grant, that's a heavyweight matchup. Who can win their matchup with Joey Spolina? I really want to see TJ Malone get some more two-man games in the Underdogs matchup against Gavin Adler. You got to put him through some more picks. And we know you can navigate him, but you got to like try to change the matchup somehow. And then on the other end, kind of what we were referencing with the Water Dogs, in terms of going up against these rookie Maryland defensive midfielders. Like, they've got a couple good – Boston has two good rookie midfielders in Mikey Weisar, and Jack Regnery has really come on this second half of the season as just an assertive, blind confidence of, I'm going to make something happen no matter what. And that is a really key attribute to have when you get into the postseason, because he doesn't care if he makes a mistake, and he usually does.
Yeah, that's a great call. That's going to be an exciting matchup, you know, because I think it's pretty much an annual tradition that, even more so than the other leagues, I mean, more so than the other teams, Maryland short stick defensive midfielders get isolated and attacked constantly. And, you know, we've seen it this year, especially, you know, deploying all these newcomers. And yeah, we've seen Mikey Weisar and we've seen Jack Regnery, you know, so quick, so unafraid, feeling very good about their matchups and about their abilities. So yeah, that's going to be a long night. Very, very difficult situation for those Maryland defensive midfielders.
Do we have any predictions? Are we giving predictions out? Or at least who should be favored and why?
Okay, that's a really good question, especially based on the last matchup going the way that it went. You know, so close and everything like that. I'm going to say, I would think the Cannons should be favored just because of the success we have seen from them. You know, I don't know how much any concept of momentum really exists and all that stuff. But if it does in fact exist, and if it's not affected by something like, you know, some downtime here, then I think the Cannons are, you know, rolling in feeling pretty good about themselves. So, you know, especially compared with the way that they ended their season, the way that the Whipsnakes ended theirs. So I'd be inclined to think the Cannons are the favorites in this one.
Yeah, I'd agree. It's hard to argue otherwise. It'd be quite an end to the career of Rob Pelinka. Will his team pass that first round? And who knows what will happen in, because anything can happen in the semifinals, of course. But listen, like, it is great news for Water Dogs fans. That I just see both these teams as, like, both these offenses can kind of collapse late in a game. And when you feel that way going into a postseason, it's tough to match up against the Goliath of the league. So it's kind of a sense of dread in the Eastern Conference that whoever wins this is kind of, let's see what you can do against Philly, but I don't know.
You're saying this is a battle to see who gets to lose to the Water Dogs in the next round?
Right, you're basically just getting a worse draft pick.
you get a trip to Salt Lake City.
Already depleted, and that doesn't really matter, of course, but and everyone wants to win the title, and of course Philadelphia has every opportunity to have as much rust and ability to not live up to their roster capabilities. But I agree. Boston should be favored. It'll be late game execution. Like, send me to the fourth quarter already in this matchup, man. 8 p.m. on a Saturday night. Let's get after it on August 29th. Because before we get there, we got to preview the Western Conference matchup between the healthy California Redwoods earning the 2 seed versus the unhealthy Denver Outlaws as the 3rd seed. Man, oh man, we referenced it at the top. They need Pat Cavanaugh and Jared Bernhardt back. So, do you have further analysis, Rosie?
Yeah, I don't know if you bring them back. I'm very curious to see what the return of both Kavanaugh and Bernhardt means to this lineup. Does that mean they're going to start dropping 15, 16 goals, you know? We heard from Tim Sudan that Kavanaugh is feeling really good, and he was at the games this past weekend, so he should be ready to go. Jared Bernhardt, we'll see, right? Like, he was kind of nursing hamstring injuries in both hamstrings, right? Like, soft tissue is no joke. Even if he does come back, his game is so heavily predicated on just flying past everybody.
Right.
Is he going to be 100%? Is he going to be cautious? Is he going to, you know, be able to go the full game? Are they going to keep him on kind of like a rep count sort of situation? I feel like even if those guys are both back, there's still so many questions with this Denver lineup. And what's going to be the effect on Brendan O'Neill's game when they are back? Is he going to be better with them there? I mean, we saw he had, 11 points in two games prior to this past weekend when they weren't in the lineup. Does he go back to kind of playing midfield? And basically the question is, like, what is going to be the net gain if they're both in there without having practiced or played in these past few weeks? You know, is that going to be an 8-goal swing in their favor? Is it going to add some goals in one direction, maybe take away some of, like, O'Neill and Dalton Young's productivity? I don't know what it means if they do, in fact, both get back there. I'm not sure it inherently is the solution to making them, you know, back to the level they were last year this time.
Yeah, I mean, you can never assume full health when these guys are fighting soft tissue stuff, but you need someone to dummy dodge at least for O'Neill to be that secondary dodger on the backside. That's where he's at his best. And it's a great shout from you to see if he can play some midfield, because, man, Chris Fake has had his number over the years. And he absolutely strapped him up strength on strength, just a power matchup there on Sunday. So if you can get him downhill going against, like, make Fake just have to monitor when he's coming out of the box or what have you, or coming up against Jared Connors, who's had an underrated LFM season one-on-one cover ability-wise, that's probably, I think, a better route to go. And I know these coaches were both pulling tactical punches in this regular season finale that didn't mean anything. So maybe that's something we see more, because whatever they were doing on Sunday wasn't working at all. And that something was seeing O'Neill being the primary dodger, Dalton Young coming out of the box, Jake Taylor and Logan Wisnowskis camping on the crease at attack. And you need more ball carriers. So get Dalton Young in attack, get Brendan O'Neill coming out of the box, and just get him to, if you're going to have him come out of the box and be the primary guy, like, you at least will have the respect of the defense. And you've seen him facilitate this season to great effect that, I mean, hopefully he doesn't go for the home run pass each time. And you can at least get that defense rotating, pass behind, a little two-man game on the backside. Like, now we're cooking with something. Man, nothing was working for poor team Tim Sudan and Jeremy Boltis in Philadelphia. So that is the biggest storyline coming in. But the California Redwoods deserve some praise for their defense. Cole Kastner and Chris Fake getting healthy is huge for them. Chris Fake is the ideal O'Neill matchup. Cole Kastner has done some yeoman's work against Pat Kavanaugh in the past. If he comes back, they've got a guy to neutralize him. And Chris Conlon can cover Jake Taylor or Logan Wisnowskis as that off-ball communicator. So they've got that side of the field covered. The other side is what Ryder Garnsey warned post-game against, where whenever they have a great game like this, they have been susceptible very susceptible to lapses when they play next. So, Rosie, how do they avoid a letdown game in the playoffs after all the really pressure kind of turns onto them? And before you answer that, I asked Logan Wisnowskis about that. Like, hey, man, like, you came into the season, your team, after a runner-up season, and you had Adam Plunkett go all in on the draft and all this stuff as with targets on your backs in the Western Conference as the undisputed favorites. Pressure is a privilege, he says, sure, but, like, there can't be any pressure or privilege on them in this matchup, because it's got to be all on the Redwoods, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I really think it is. You know, the Redwoods are kind of in the next stage of kind of their progression towards building their championship lineup. I think they looked to, you know, maybe fill in some holes in this previous offseason. And I think they've gotten to a point now where at least they, you know, you ask, say, yes, Joe Spallina, and he'll tell you, you know, it's championship or bust every year, right? But the very least, I think they need to continue progressing, you know, in a positive direction, so they don't have to kind of reassess and then maybe kind of circle back and start over. It is kind of their time to take that next step if they can do so. And, you know, they do have some new pieces in play that could really help them get there. I think that side of things really starts with what we saw from Finn Thompson these past few games from him. He looked like he'd been in this offense for a very long time this past weekend. They're really working well with his skill set. He's the kind of guy who, once other people around him learn, you know, maybe how best to operate with him, how to understand his cutting style and elements of his game, they can really kind of all elevate their game accordingly. We saw that Ryder Garnsey talking about, you know, just how great it's been to work with Finn Thompson. And I think someone like that adds a couple wrinkles to the offense that maybe they hadn't really had before with some of their other guys. You know, you do have Dylan Malloy, who I'd say is what we've seen him do really well is kind of a lot of like dodging off crease or else kind of barreling towards it. And then you kind of have Thompson kind of working in the margins in between that sort of stuff, very kind of slither off ball play. And, you know, if you have your McAdories and your Barcasels kind of working, you know, towards the alley, initiating elements like that, I think what Thompson kind of adds is almost like a cherry on top to what had, you know, had been building in a positive direction for quite a while. So, yeah, I think the pressure's on them. And, you know, particularly after this last matchup, although it was against a lot of people who, if all things continue to go, or I should say, if things go the way that Tim Sudan hopes, won't be deployed the next time around. You know, ideally have all of his starting defense back and things like that. But, you know, sometimes good plays are good plays, right? Regardless of who's on there trying to stop you. So, yeah, as far as pressure goes, I would say a lot of it and expectations should be heading towards the Redwood side. I think the Outlaws, if they have a collapse, there's a lot of, I'm not saying they would deploy them, but there's a lot of kind of excuses we could point out if something goes pretty wrong for the Outlaws at this point. And the Redwoods don't have that kind of stuff in their bag.
A little less likely to see the starting close defense from what Tim Sudan said in tone-wise in the post-game presser. We will continue to monitor in this matchup, because obviously if you get JT Giles-Harris, Mike Manley, and Ben Randall back, that is a different story against that attack. Chris Kavanaugh really liked that diving backhander against Ryan Tarafenko. I think Terry's been kind of the D-mid of the year, and that was kind of a play indicative of, like, listen, I'm going to take it whenever I get a shorty, and I'm Chris Kavanaugh. And not the best game from him. That was his best highlight. Speaking about Thompson and Malloy, that BTB to BTB, number one on SportsCenter, top 10, of course. Can't miss it. That was one of the best highlights of the weekend. The whether it's Cali or Denver, who do you think is a better matchup for Utah?
Man, I mean, historically, I feel like there's just been so much with the whole Denver-Utah thing, but that's kind of more, I guess, a testament to the success they both had, that they've kind of been in one another's way recently. Man, I feel like it would be interesting to see what California would do presented with that opportunity. But they really have to try to make that interior defense work really hard. And they've had a lot of success there. So it would be tough to see. I'm still, man, I think, you know, it's tough. It's tough to say, like, because we've seen, like, Dylan Malloy have some success, but we've also seen him quieted a bit as well. But, man, I don't know. You stumped me on that one. If I had to pick, but then I was like, okay, Denver. But, you know, we've seen O'Neal have his games against Utah, and we've also seen him, you know, like Lavelle, kind of quiet him as well, you know? I don't know. What does one team jump out to you as kind of maybe having some sort of edge on Utah here?
You know, that's why I asked you the question. No, I think the Redwoods, to me, healthy-wise, if they're playing at full strength to the best of their potential, pose more of a threat right now because of that health issue. And quite frankly, when you have Andrew McAdory and Sam English coming off the wings of faceoffs, Sistelberger's had a great year, and I think he matches up really well with TD Erland because they have a lot of shared history and train together. But I like TD Erland in the playoffs. And when you get one of the best, if not the best, 32-second shot clock offense in the league, that many extra possessions. I like what they've had defensively. I like the Redwoods. I like the Redwoods in that semifinal matchup, posing a bigger threat. If you had to put a gun to my head, really, that's what I'm saying. Not that you do, not that anyone can prove that you don't, but we digress. Rosie, any in memoriam thoughts for Carolina and New York before we sign off before the next pod?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's a nice time to send a shout out to, say, Carolina. Let's start with them. I guess this is the conclusion of Chad Palumbo summer.
Oh, no, that's well, he's playing in the Pan American lacrosse tournament with Team USA right now, so not over yet, Rosie.
Okay, all right. Well, good. Because that's been a fantastic time.
I'll play the, like, I will remember in the background while you do this.
To get him flashing on the screen here, some slow motion for it. What a tremendously fun rookie season from that guy. Productive, of course. Great play from him. Confident play, tossing the BTBs left and right, but above all else, just what a fun season, entertaining season from that guy.
Flipping lids.
Yeah, just setting the standard for having a good time on the field. And, you know, I think they saw a lot with their newcomers that they're feeling pretty good about. Teddy Malone really came on strong there, and I think they feel like they really got something in him. You know, from a quarterbacking standpoint, making the whole offense better. You know, like anybody, they'll have their questions moving forward, positions that need to be addressed, and things like that that they'll either be working on through the draft or some trades or something like that. sure Spencer Ford is cooking something up as we speak. Mighty fun season from some of those newcomers. Lots of good source for optimism moving forward. Get well soon, Jack Rowlett as well. And New York Atlas, tough season. You know, everything that could go wrong did. You know, almost every position had some guys dropping out at some point or another. Man, as far as, like, I'm saying, like, what are some, I'm trying to do kind of a glass half full kind of thing to close things out for the Atlas. You know, I mean, theoretically, it's probably not going to be this bad again. You know, just as far as injuries and stuff go, like, that's a lot of injuries. It's probably, you know, law of averages. These guys should be better than this next time around. You know, every day is a little bit closer to Jeff Teat coming back. And, you know, everybody can get rested up. I will say this for him. Got a ton of guys locked into deals through, like, 2028. So, you know, if you do like what you have on paper there and you believe in those guys, you know, you don't have to be quite so nervous this offseason as you might have been in the past. So shout out to Tyler Lowe for getting those deals done up in New York, kind of retaining some of those guys as well.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. Well, the first two picks of the drafts, New York, Carolina. Can you pair get a little more passing in that Carolina offense, maybe Nate Kibiri with some Owen Hiltz. If he doesn't take a fifth year, it's too hard to say with all these fifth year stuff. Bobby Van Buren, one of the top D guys available. See if he can come in and help this ailing, struggle-filled New York defense. It'll be tough. And as we close out the chapter on the Atlas and the chaos, we open this new chapter of the playoffs. In memoriam goes the PLL Happy Hour podcast regular season edition. It's playoff time, Rosie. Time to bring our A games here. Should we do something for the playoffs? Or should we, like, grow? Should you not shave at all? And should we grow some playoff beards? What should we do?
Playoff beards is a solid idea. What's the beard situation looking like for you? How's that?
I can grow it. It takes a while, so maybe next playoffs. By the time 2027 rolls around, I can.
You need that.
I need a little more advanced.
Owen Hiltz does it. Owen Hiltz grows a beard in about 25 minutes.
Anyway, well, we'll think of something, and we'll have plenty more coverage here on InsideTheCross.com, and back with more PLL Happy Hour podcast wherever you get your podcast episodes. So make sure to check back here, and we'll have plenty more coverage. Rosie, always a pleasure.
Yes, sir. See you next time.